Hey everyone, Chris Wan here. This is Accent Out Loud, a podcast about one person's take on English language learning, accent modification, and communication. So I'm on my way to work today. We're going to try and figure out today's episode. I want to continue a little bit with that idea that I was practicing an Australian accent, trying to pause as I go to try and give you insight into what I'm trying to listen to and what I notice about an accent. Just going to drive into work today, but we'll do another podcast and just sort of listen as we go. Same idea. Check the episode I did last week to get the gist of it. Today we're going to do something a little bit different, so I'm not going to pause necessarily as often. I might just speak on top of the podcast itself, over top the podcast that we're listening to. Same speaker, Wendy Zuckerman, different episode. And the idea is, again, I'm going to pause, interrupt, talk over with the intent of framing up what I hear as a speech language pathologist in somebody's accent and try and give insight into how I see and hear things. Now, because I already have a native English accent, it's a bit different, but it's the best thing I can do as a native speaker to try and approximate how I think or how I perceive what non-native English speakers are going through.
Hi, I'm Wendy Zuckerman, and you're listening to Science Versus from Gimlet.
Science Versus from Gimlet.
This is the show that pits facts against anaphylaxis.
So last time, on the last episode, I raised some flags in terms of things that are different between a North American English accent, general American, general Canadian English accent versus an Australian accent. The things that we talked about were sort of the hard R sound. So we're not really going to hear hard R's. It's more like, for example, the word bear wouldn't be more of a bear. Shark last week was one of the main words, and it's more of a shark instead of shark, so we're not hearing that hard R sound. And then the vowels are a bit more backed. What I'm hearing is more so open mouth postures, more exaggerated mouth movements, elongated manipulations of vowel sounds, specifically when they're going through diphthongs, which is a transition from one vowel to another vowel within the same syllable. Other things that I noticed were the up and down exaggeration almost of their intonational pattern. It's a bit more sing-songy, at least the way that I noticed it. And there was a lot more raising intonation, which sounds almost like a question when she's talking. It's a bit more common now, but it's something worth noting. It might just be, again, specific to her. But the intention was to analyze how she sounds. So if that's specific to her, then that's something that I'm picking up. And that's something specific to her individual accent.
This is the show that pits anaphylaxis.
So what I'm doing now is I'm just sort of talking overhead with the intention of immediately practicing and immediately attempting to imitate exactly what I'm seeing or what I'm hearing. Mimicry is one of those things that is in the research, and it's a strong proponent for how one builds or develops an accent. We are sort of hardwired as human beings to pick these things up, to notice differences in sound production. And there is research to suggest that when I hear an accent different from mine, I will try to accommodate or approximate what I say to sound more similar to what I hear. Now, the social behavioral evolutionary sort of argument for that might be that by accommodating, by almost unconsciously starting to sound like other people who are a little bit more different in terms of how their sound repertoire, is that you're building trust, you're building communication, you're sort of on a sound level trying to be similar to the person that you're interacting with. And evolutionary wise, being similar, being sort of having that in-group, out-group, knows who you belong with or who you want to belong with or who you want to align yourself with. So I can see the argument for that. And so basically, I know this is kind of long-winded, this is kind of far-fetched, but the idea is I want you to realize what I'm doing when I'm mimicking. I think a lot of times the concern with that people have when they're practicing is they're not fully committing, there's no full commitment or going 100% onto this sort of communication. So the want for me is that I can show you what I'm trying to do when I try my Australian English accent, my general Australian English accent, to hone in on what is going to be effective in helping you with that communication and what may not necessarily be as effective. And I think a lot of times when people are learning a new accent, they don't know how to hone it down or dial it down to specifically what they need to change or what they can improve. With learning an English accent, I think that a lot of times when I ask clients or when I pose the question, they can tell something's different. They can tell, oh, I don't sound this way, or this certain thing is a bit different. But I don't think they fully necessarily grasp as a whole how many different things are moving, all the different moving parts in an accent. So it's really helpful to have that imitation feedback right afterwards so that you can try it out immediately after and notice the different things involved. Maybe you can get the sounds that you want, but maybe the pitch or the delivery or the pacing is not the same. And so all of those are actually key components to an accent and one's delivery for communication. And even amongst native English speakers, being a more effective English speaker involves these nuanced pieces of delivery, intonation, changes in loudness, changes in pitch, changes in your ability to not have so many interjections, ums, ahs, your ability to sound confident when you are speaking versus rising that tone at the end, rising that pitch at the end to literally give the cues of a question when you don't really necessarily mean a question. I know for one, myself, I tend to be a largely apathetic person. I don't really necessarily make my emotions as exaggerated as I think other people would appreciate when I'm communicating. So as a result, I do come off apathetic, monotone at times. So one thing that I can do as a communicator, even if I'm not necessarily feeling more emotional, is to intentionally change my pitch, change my pacing, change my loudness so that people really get the breadth of and depth of my communication and pick up on the nuances that I want them to pick up on to be a better, effective communicator.
Anaphylaxis.
Within the last few decades,
has gone from
one of America's favorite snack foods to public enemy number one.
Teenager has died after having...
You really hear number one, not number, number.
Has died after having an allergic reaction to peanuts.
Peanuts have been banned on airlines and schools.
No peanut products in the classroom means lunchboxes are kept in the hall.
Another thing that I want to talk about was I talked about twang last week, but it wasn't really, I didn't have a great definition of it. And so I delved a little bit deeper, looked online, see what researchers and voice coaches and things like that are saying about twang. And twang reflects an actual anatomical difference to the vocal tract. So it's an interesting thing because I don't think, at least from a speech language pathology point of view, when I'm focused on whether or not a child is able to pick up a certain sound properly or a adult is able to regain some of the communication they might have lost after a stroke, twang is not a high priority. I can definitely see it being an impactful thing for a voice coach, for a actor, for anyone who is on that upper echelon of communication who is trying to tweak how confident they might sound or how commanding of a voice that they have, but twang is not something that I've typically dealt with. Now, from the voice coaches, from the research about it, twang appears to be the lowering of the epiglottis. And what it essentially means, let me backtrack a second. Epiglottis is a flap inside the throat. You can look it up online. Basically, it's not that important for your purposes, but essentially what my understanding of it is, they're opening the throat as essentially a better resonance chamber for your voice. So just like when you think of an instrument and how the shape of the instrument you're playing, particularly your brass instruments, your trombone, maybe even your wind instrument. So your trombone, your tuba, your saxophone, the shape of that brass instrument determines the overall sound of it. The larger the bell of the instrument, so I'm thinking tuba versus trumpet, for example, the larger the shape, the more deep or low bass that sound necessarily might count. What trumpets, things with narrower shapes might do to compensate is you have to use more breath, you have to use a louder, more effort, forcing that air through, and that generates your louder sound. But my understanding of twang is it considerably a vocal technique that is used to increase the efficiency of your sound, in the sense that you are able to generate a louder sound, able to generate a more full-bodied sound, and able to generate a resonance in the throat in the throat space, which facilitates that loudness. Now, sometimes with that increased resonance, people apparently can mischaracterize that as nasally, which is what I briefly alluded to when I mentioned it last week, but it's not actually nasal, it's more throat-based. Anyways, it was something interesting for me. I thought I might as well share it, and we'll just keep going on.
Means lunchboxes are kept in the hall. According to the CDC,
in the U.S. have peanut allergies. 1.4%.
It's quadrupled since the
90s.
According to the most recent data,
So it's data. Sometimes I hear more data. Depending on where you are in the English-speaking world, you might get a bit of a difference. Data. But it's almost that A sound is so elongated for me. It's so dragged out compared. It's like half a split second longer for all her vowels. She really takes a little bit more time, and it comes across as more emphasis. When I'm saying it to myself, my gut instinct is to say data or data, but data, if I'm going to say it that way. She almost says data. And maybe it's her broadcasting voice, maybe it's her podcasting voice that wants her to fully enunciate her sounds, and so there's maybe a longer duration for each of those sounds, but it's something worth noting.
According to the monkeys in the ear, a peanut. So today's mini episode.
So you can hear the exact difference comparison between so and so. There's a lot more exaggerated transition of her initial vowel sound to the final vowel sound. So, and I'm almost like really enunciating so. Sort of an upwards tense, I feel it in my cheeks when I'm saying so, and then I really round my lips and protrude my lips at the end of that so, versus when I say it myself, so I go straight or very quickly towards that final lip position, and the overall duration of the vowel is much shorter. But you can notice when I'm trying to imitate quite shortly after. I sometimes don't catch all the sounds. I sometimes don't catch all the words. That's fine. I think what you really want to get into that rhythm of is being immediately afterwards, repeating what she's saying, trying it with the same intonation, trying it with the same sounds that you're hearing, and really trying to dial in that rhythmic characterization that she has on those words in that sequence. I don't care. It's not as important whether you hit this word, that word. It's the whole overall presentation of it that is important. And I think sometimes there is a misplacement of all your efforts where you might get bogged down on specific words. And I think we want to get past that. The frustration is unnecessarily focused on one specific sound or one specific target. And what is really more important is the overall delivery as well. Yes, the individual words are important. It's important to get the right sound. It's important to get the right pitch. But it's also the overall delivery beyond the individual sounds. It's the pacing. It's the word choice. It's the evaluation of what are words that are worth saying slower so that they're communicated more effectively versus what are the words that you say quicker because maybe they're not as important words.
Because of a peanut.
Because of a peanut.
So in today's mini episode,
we're asking
what is going on
with all these peanut allergies.
Is there anything parents can do about it?
Is there anything parents can
do
about
it?
And what is?
We'll get to all that story.
So story, you have that R now. The reason you have that R, that hard R sound that you really do hear, is it's because it's beginning the second syllable, story. You can hear, if you don't know the concept of syllables, it's basically how many beats to a word, how many claps, if I had to clap out a word. Another way that you can think of it is if you could not say any sounds, if you had to hum, so if you had to hum out the words, how many hums are there? So in story, there's there's two. If it was car, one. And so building your understanding of syllable structure, of your sounds that you're learning and sort of rhyming, those are all going to be helpful for figuring out that piece. So with the word story, because the R is important at the beginning, even for people who drop R's or don't have such a hard R. So I'm talking about British people. I'm pretty sure most British accents drop the R. Some American accents, less general Canadian American accents, we will produce that hard R. But that's when you might hear the different. So story, everyone's gonna say it because the R is the beginning of the second syllable, but maybe for star, the word star, you won't hear it. You might get more of a sta instead of star. So for the word Starbucks, it might be Starbucks versus Starbucks.
That's cold.
I may have to blow my nose, so embarrassingly.
Gideon is a pediatrician and allergy researcher at King's College London.
Okay.
London.
Thanks.
Gideon told us that back in the 90s, we're seeing more.
When she says that word 90s, it's really nasal. That's what I'm picking up. I mean, right now, mine is pretty nasal too, but it's more allergies and nasal congestion. But that'll change the way you sound. But for her, it may be that twang, it may be that nasality that I'm hearing when she's particularly saying 90s.
Researchers, we're seeing more and more kids with peanut allergy.
That R is not as hard.
Allergies.
Allergies.
Really very weird and versatile.
I'm not going to particularly mimic him because it doesn't matter for him. Severe allergic reaction.
The cheek swelling, diarrhea, vomiting, swelling of the airways, difficulty breathing, loss of consciousness.
And so, in the late 90s,
allergy got together.
All these kids
getting these nasty.
And they decided to start giving some parents.
Some very clear advice. Nasty. Again, that's that backed A sound. Instead of nasty, asty, nasty. It's more of a back of the mouth sound. And so, as I'm going through this, these are the things that keep coming up, the trends. And these are the trends that you really have to dial in when you want to put on an accent. So North American, General American, English accents have trends or have characteristics that yours may not. So for example, if a British person wants to learn a General American accent, they're gonna have to learn to produce that R sound all the time, that hard R sound all the time. And if they're not doing that, then that makes that accent less believable. So like I said before, if you want to start knowing what are the characteristics of your specific accent that you want to achieve, that needs to always be on the forefront of what you need to do differently. When you're thinking of speaking out loud in English and you want that English accent, that General American accent, you need to know the criteria of what is different. What is different in your English accent to theirs? And you need to be able to rattle it off, and you need to be able to think about it as you're speaking.
Parents.
Don't feed your baby's peanuts.
Don't feed your baby's peanuts.
In the year 2000, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with guidelines just this.
A lot of babies shouldn't be eating nuts.
No peanut butter, no peanut cookies. Until
they're 3 years old.
And this advice was particularly advice for babies with high risk of getting peanut allergies.
Other food allergies, or eczema.
Really bad rashes. We know that that's the group that goes on to have peanut allergy.
And eczema is common in babies. Which
eczema is common in babies.
The advice to put the peanut butter on the high shelf. Our producer Rose Rimler asked Gideon about it. Were you telling your patients that?
Yes, I was telling my patients that. I was giving that advice to my own family as well.
Own family as well.
It seemed intuitively true.
Intuitively true.
By avoiding peanuts.
By avoiding peanuts.
Cocooning the baby.
Cocooning the baby.
Development of allergies.
And so after those guidelines in 2000 came out.
In 2000 came out. Doctors across the US and UK. Don't give your babies peanuts.
And the world chugged along for a few years. Harry Potter got made into movies.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Britney Spears shaved her head. A lot happened during the 2000s. Peanut allergies didn't go away. The advice to banish Nutter Butters from the kitchen.
Nutter Butters.
Didn't seem to be working. Studies were finding that kids who weren't eating peanuts were still becoming allergic.
And
Gideon had noticed it too.
And so I think the way that you imitate helps to establish what you expect is going to happen and predict what is going to happen when you are talking this way. And the intent is if you can spontaneously know what you need to do differently to talk this way, you've got your accent. You've got the accent you want. If you can spontaneously determine what and how words should be said and deliver them in a way that is similar to what you're imitating, then you've got the accent that you want. But I think people don't necessarily practice accents this way because it's quite an overload of stimuli. You have to hear, you have to listen to what you're saying, you have to listen to what they're saying, you have to get into the habit of moving that mouth quickly to the different shapes that you're trying, exploring the different soundscape. And what ends up happening is you get a little bit better and a little bit better And if you do that over a month, maybe, then maybe you can pick it up that way.
Allergic to them.
Allergic to them.
Was really from listening.
Really from listening
to my patients.
To my patients.
What were they saying to you?
Well, they were saying to you? I just don't understand.
I just don't understand.
Child peanuts.
Peanut peanuts.
And yet, allergy.
My child has
so
developed.
What was going on?
So what was going on?
Gideon found the answer.
So that's an interesting one. Answer versus answer. So answer sounds more British, UK, and maybe that's where the differentiation between British and Australian comes. I think for an untrained ear, they do sound similar. There's certain characteristics that are similar between the two. Obviously, if you ask an Australian person or a British person, they might say that they don't sound at all the same. But there is an example of what I would think answer might be more British, but you get answer, which is more Australian. But it's interesting because you also get answer instead of answer, which has the hard R sound. The hard R sound would determine that it's a North American accent. So it's kind of a mishmash between the two. It's not quite fully British, which would be more ansa, and it's not quite North American, which would be answer. So it's more of an ansa, a middle ground. Anyways, I got to my workplace. It's 4 minutes and 30 seconds into the podcast, and I've talked for now 30 minutes. And so the idea behind it is just sort of, you don't need to look far for stimuli, for practice, for things that you can do. I've driven to work. I've got 30 minutes of practicing an accent that I don't know how to do. And the next thing that I would want to do out of this is, okay, after I've imitated it for a bit, print out a script, try and use what you've learned or what you think an Australian English accent might be, and then maybe hear it back from an Australian English person. So, for example, I know TED Talks online, you can print the transcript. So if you find an Australian English speaker, an Australian English presenter, print off the transcript, tape yourself saying that transcript before you've even heard it from them. Tape yourself, see what you say, how you think an Australian English accent person might deliver it. Hear how they actually deliver it. And then you can compare and contrast which words, the delivery, how they said it, how you said it, where did they pause, where did they not pause. Did they always have this rising intonation, or was rising pitch questions when they talk? Or is that more specific to Wendy Zuckerman that we've been hearing a little bit today? And that's how you slowly, slowly, slowly build your accent. And I think it's important enough for me to try and do this myself, because I don't know an Australian accent. This is just what I'm doing to try and pick it up on the side. So it'd be really cool, I think, and inspiring if I could learn an Australian accent or a general Australian accent and be able to demonstrate to you, yeah, at the beginning it was shit, I couldn't do it, but maybe gradually over time it got better, I tweaked it a little bit, and now it's a decent Australian accent. So that'll be something that I'm going to put in my books to do. I'll keep recording as I go, keep practicing, show you what I got, and hopefully you get some inspiration out of this. Anyways, see you next time.
If you like what you're hearing, or even if you aren't, let me know. I know this podcast can be something great and educational for a lot of people. I'm here to listen, so give me your take, your likes, your dislikes, and maybe we can make this into something that'll help a lot of people. Leave a rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Once I figure out how to read the reviews, I'm sure it'll help.